It was on a Tuesday night. Nisa Mickens and Kayla Cuevas were walking down a street when, all of a sudden, a gang of four people descended on them. What happened next was the stuff of nightmares. The four people proceeded to attack the two girls with machetes and baseball bats. According to local law enforcement in Brentwood, New York, when the body of Nisa Mickens was found on Starley Street in Brentwood on September the 13th, 2016, it was evident that she had gone through hell before her death. According to the local medical examiner, Nisa had more than 10 wounds to her face and head, and according to Robert Capers, a U.S. District Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Nisa was so badly beaten around her face that she was barely recognizable. Nisa was just a day from her 16th birthday. Her lifelong friend, Kayla Cuevas, was found dead the next day in a nearby backyard, just a few hundred feet from where Nisa was found. Both girls died of blunt force trauma and cutting injuries to the head and face. According to law enforcement, on September 13, 2016, MS-13 members were driving around the neighborhood, hunting for rival gang members to kill. While they were driving through Brentwood, gang members Selvin Chavez, Enrique Portillo, and two unnamed juvenile members saw Kayla and Nisa walking down Starley Street. They then called the leaders of the Sailors Clique, their lock of action of MS-13, who told them to kill the girls. Chavez, who was driving, pulled up to the girls, then Portillo and the other two unnamed gang members jumped out and attacked the girls with baseball bats and machetes. After they were done, they jumped back into the car and Chavez drove away. Welcome to Society of Strife. This week, we'll be talking about MS-13, the world's most dangerous street gang. We'll also talk about the gang's origins in LA, its subsequent deportation to Central America, and its spread from the US and into Europe. We'll also discuss why the gang has remained strong despite a lot of attempts by local and international law enforcement officers to bring it down. Please remember to give the show a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts /iTunes. And if you can, to support it on patreon.com/societyofstrife and buymeacoffee.com/societyofstrife. If you can't, that's understandable. Please spread the word about the show to your friends and family, as this would help the show immensely. Before I get started on MS-13, let's talk about some strife news, or what I like to call my off my chest and onto yours segment. First, let's talk about the shooting in Boulder, Colorado, which was done by yet another 21-year-old. The shooting ended up claiming 10 people's lives, including a police officer who was first on the scene. The gunman, Ahmad Al-Aliwi Alisa, was using a pistol variant of the AR-556, which is in itself a variant of the AR-15. Now, I don't have much to say about this shooting, apart from offering my condolences to the victims of the shooting and their families, but I do have a lot to say about mass shootings in general. On the day I record this episode, which is on Thursday, I've got to say that I'm sickened by some politicians' response to this shooting and the one that happened last week. I mean, 18 people have lost their lives in 2 weeks, and you're saying that Democrats are coming after your guns? And before you get mad at me for speaking my mind, please remember this: I have no skin in US politics, and therefore, I am the most unbiased person to be talking about this right now. America, the whole world is watching, and it is wondering why you guys haven't placed a blanket ban on guns, or at least banned assault rifles and high-capacity mags. In other parts of the USA, a little update from the Georgia shooter, Robert Alan Long. So apparently, the FBI don't believe that the shooting was race-motivated. How they came to that conclusion, I have no idea. But because they're the experts, I expect they'll say why. I really hope that they're not buying his sex addiction story, because that story is just bonkers. By the way, as I was reading about the Colorado shooting, as I was fact-checking those news, I discovered that the AR-15 assault rifle and its variants happens to be the gun most widely used by mass shooters and drug cartels around the world. Because of this, I'll be releasing a bonus episode on AR-15s, and I'll talk about its history, variants, and why it has become the most loved and most hated weapon in the US and other parts of the world, such as Australia. Please note that, however, that I will not be referencing any mass shootings in that episode, because that would just be in bad taste. So keep an eye on your Society of Strife podcast feed between now and Monday, or click subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts to get notified the second it comes out. Before I get started on the main show, I'd also like to talk a little bit about Australia and the flooding that has been taking place there. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with Strife, but it has my second favorite subject, climate change. As many of you may have noticed, Australia seems to be suffering weather that's getting more and more severe as each year goes by. Now, it's alternating between burning and flooding. Now, for those who don't know, Australia happens to be the world's largest coal miner. Go figure. Australian Gen Zs, millennials, along with native communities have tried protesting against these mining activities, which are destroying the environment, but their pleas have fallen on deaf ears. Apparently, the Australian government is more concerned with making a dime than caring for planet Earth. The funny thing is, if it was China doing the same, we'd all be judging them. And there's a documentary on Netflix called Seaspiracy, like seas, you know, the seven seas, and piracy like Blackbeard. It came out on 24th March, and I advise you guys to go watch it. Believe me, it's eye-opening. All that aside, let's talk about MS-13. So before I get started on MS-13, let's talk about the Salvadoran Civil War, which took place in El Salvador, as the name obviously suggests. The Civil War was fought between military-led junta government of El Salvador and the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front, or FMLN. The FMLN was a coalition of left-wing groups, which was formed on the 10th of October, 1980. It was made up of the following groups: the Fuerzas Populares de Liberación, Farabundo Marti, or FPL, People's Revolutionary Army, or ERP, Resistencia Nacional, or RN, the Partido Comunista Salvadoreño, PCS, and the Partido Revolucionario de los Trabajadores Centroamericanos, or PRTC. The Civil War lasted from 15th October 1979 to 16th January 1992. Its official start remains unclear, though it is assumed that it started after a coup on October 15th, 1979, in which young military officers overthrew President Carlos Humberto Romero. The coup was bloodless, but the military junta, which took over immediately, started killing anti-coup protesters. In return, guerrilla groups started killing anti-disorder protesters, which meant you either had to be on one side or the other. The coup was sponsored by the United States, which immediately recognized the military junta as the legitimate leaders of El Salvador. This was despite all the killings that the junta was perpetrating. The fully-fledged civil war lasted for more than 12 years and included deliberate terrorizing and targeting of civilians by U.S.-trained death squads, the targeting of prominent Catholic clergy, and the use of child soldiers, among a host of other human rights violations, most of which were committed by members of the military junta. During the war, more than 75,000 people were killed and an unknown number of people disappeared. The United States contributed to the conflict by providing military aid of $1.2 million a day to the government of El Salvador during the Carter and Reagan administrations, and also provided significant training to the soldiers. The reason why the US decided to ignore the various human rights violations perpetrated by the government was because the military junta was considered an ally, at least in terms of the context of the Cold War. By May of 1983, US officers went a step further and began taking over positions in the top levels of the Salvadoran military and were making critical decisions and running the war. According to the UN, FMLN guerrillas were responsible for 5% of acts of violence targeting civilians, while the military junta committed 85% of such crimes. 1990, the UN began peace negotiations, and on January 16, 1992, an agreement, the Chapultepec Peace Accords, was signed by the combatants in Mexico City, formally ending the conflict. Now that we've covered that part, let's talk about MS-13's connection to the Civil War. So it all began with the refugees. When the Civil War started, a lot of people left the country and sought refugee status in neighboring countries. Some of these refugees made their way to the United States, but because the US supported the military junta in El Salvador, it refused to offer political asylum to the refugees. Instead, it gave them all an undocumented immigrant status. As the years went by, refugees from El Salvador did not bother to seek political asylum. Instead, they entered the US illegally and settled within undocumented immigrant communities in cities like Los Angeles. MS-13 began in such a place. Originally, MS-13, or Mara Salvatrucha, was a group of young, delinquent people who shared similar tastes in music. However, due to severe racial prejudices that undocumented people in LA experienced, the Maras quickly transformed into a gang. Its initial goal, or so it claimed, was to protect the local Salvadoran community from extortion by other, more well-established gangs, which were predominantly made up of Asians, Mexicans, and African Americans. The gang became more organized under the leadership of Ernesto Deras. Deras was a former member of Salvadoran Special Forces and was trained in Panama by the Green Beret at the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. The Green Berets are the Special Forces branch of the US Army. After becoming the leader, Ernesto Deras used his military training to discipline the gang and improve its logistical operations. It was because of Deras that the gang began to grow in power. Now, before I get into the rabbit hole that is MS-13, let's talk a little bit about the 18th Street Gang, because it will be featuring quite a lot in this episode. The 18th Street Gang is sort of a sister gang to MS-13, although the two don't see eye to eye. What makes them so similar is that they both share the same roots in LA and almost have similar numbers in terms of personnel. Both gangs are also transnational, meaning that they are present in more than one country. In fact, both MS-13 and 18th Street Gangs are located in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. It is their fierce rivalry that has turned the entire region of the three countries into the region with the highest homicide rates on the planet. Unlike MS-13, the 18th Street Gang is multi-ethnic and allows anybody of any race to join its ranks. It is predominantly Mexican, but has African-American and Asian-American members. According to most crime experts, the 18th Street Gang is larger than MS-13 because not only is the 18th Street Gang present in 120 cities in 37 states and the District of Columbia, it's also present internationally in countries such as Spain, Australia, Canada, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Lebanon, Peru, Ecuador, and Mexico. Both MS-13 and 18th Street Gangs are known to recruit from elementary and middle schools. They recruit from high schools in those countries that don't follow the American system, such as the UK. So, let's talk about the MS-13 in detail. The Mara Salvatrucha is the most dangerous criminal organization on the planet. While it can trace its roots back to poor Salvadoran immigrants, it has now spread from Central and North America to Europe. While they are largely a predatory criminal organization, living off extortion, prostitution, and drug trafficking, the gang has very strong social attachments. Most of these attachments can be attributed to their initiation methods, which involve a 13-second beating and a serious crime that is committed by the initiate, such as a murder. The origins of the name MS-13 are still disputed, but Mara is the Central American name for a gang, Salva refers to El Salvador, and Trucha is slang for clever or sharp. According to other sources, however, the name comes from La Mara, which is a street in San Salvador, the capital city of El Salvador. And Salvatrucha, meaning the Salvatrucha guerrillas who fought in the Salvadoran Civil War. The Salvatrucha guerrillas were members of the FMLN, which opposed the military junta in the war. Salvatruchas was also the name given to the people who fought against William Walker, who was a businessman and proponent of slavery from the US who tried to subdue parts of Central America in the 1850s. Walker, after declaring himself the president of Nicaragua, was overrun and executed by the Salvatruchas. Originally, MS-13 was referred to as the Mara Salvatrucha Stoners, but that changed after Ernesto Deras took power in the 1990s. Obviously, he felt that nobody would ever take them seriously with a name like the Mara Salvatrucha Stoners, and so the MSS became the MS. The MS gained power, but unfortunately for them, rival gangs took notice, and that's when the conflict started. Allegedly, it all began with the 18th Street Gang. Earlier, the MS and the 18th Street Gang, or Barrio 18 as it was known at the time, got along quite well, but they had some falling out, presumably over a woman. What happened was, two gang members from MS and Barrio 18 were arguing over a woman, and the MS gangster was shot and killed. What followed was a series of retaliatory attacks by both gangs, and a bitter rivalry that still exists to this day. All the fighting put them on local law enforcement radars, who then started arresting and detaining them in large numbers in the late 1980s and early 1990s. After MS members ended up in prison, they discovered that they were still the underdogs after they came across the Mexican Mafia, or La M. The Mexican Mafia's powers extended from the jail to the streets. The Mafia's umbrella, known as the Sureños, included many prominent gangs that stretched into the southwest of Mexico and the US. After coming across the Mexican Mafia, the MS decided that the best thing for them to do was play a subservient role. This benefited them because the MS was granted more protection on the streets and in the prison. In return, the MS provided the Mexican Mafia with hitmen and also paid regular quarters from their proceeds. It also added the number 13 to its name, which is the number the letter M occupies on the alphabet. And just like that, MS-13 was born. By the mid-1990s, the US had had enough. And so, as part of their push towards stricter immigration laws and as part of a way to deal with such gangs, President Bill Clinton's administration began a program of deportation of foreign-born residents convicted of a range of crimes. This enhanced deportation increased the number of gang members being sent home to El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and other places such as Mexico. It was at this point that the US government made the worst blunder imaginable, and why experts get irritated when they hear people like Trump and Ted Cruz saying that immigrants bring with them criminal activities, with Trump going as far as to call Mexican immigrants rapists. So forget funding dictators, tyrants and murderers, and denying immigrants political asylum when they needed it. When the US government started deporting immigrants with gang connections, what they did was seed countries without effective law enforcement with gang members. As a result, gang activity exploded in countries such as Honduras and El Salvador, which then more than tripled criminal activity and homicide rates in these countries. This, of course, led to higher rates of immigrants illegally crossing into the US to escape the violence, and because these immigrants had no opportunities, they were forced into the same gangs they were running away from. When you look at history, from the US activities in propping up the military junta and its denial of political asylum to Central American refugees, and then to the exportation of gangs from the US into Central American countries which could not cope, it's no surprise that law enforcement experts have openly called the MS-13, quote, an American creation, end quote. According to one estimate, 20,000 criminals returned to Central America between 2000 and 2004. Since 2016, that number has only gone higher. These convicts, who often had only the faintest connection to their countries of birth, especially because they left as kids, had little chance of integrating into society, and as a result, simply went back into the gang life they knew. In this way, the decision to use policy as an anti-gang tool helped seed the virulent growth of MS-13 in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. MS-13's criminal activities vary from one region to another. In Central America, MS-13 has evolved into a ruthless criminal enterprise rather than a traditional street gang. It is divided into neighborhood structures called clickers or cliques, which are grouped into programmers, that's programmers in Spanish, which is of course programs in English, that respond to the RANFLA or national leadership in each country. Each clicker is responsible for its own economic needs, as well as payments to the central leadership, meaning that each clicker and each programmer is different. Some are wealthy, while some are very poor. For example, a clicker that is responsible for managing cocaine transportation is quite wealthy, while a clicker that only deals in extortion is quite poor. However, despite MS-13 having such a complicated hierarchy with haves and have-nots, it has been able to become a political and economic juggernaut in Central America. One of the ways it has been able to achieve this is by following a strategy it developed around 4 years ago. So, what the MS-13 allegedly does nowadays is send its members to infiltrate police and military organizations in Honduras and El Salvador. It does this by selecting bright members from within its ranks and sending them to schools and universities around the two countries. These bright members even have the chance to become respected members of society by following respectable careers as lawyers, accountants, MBAs, and even doctors. Another step that the gang has taken is the decision to stop extorting small businesses that operate in the gang's territory. As much as this has lost them a significant amount of revenue, it bought them substantial political goodwill from these communities, and they were able to find an alternate source of funding from larger companies such as those transporting fuel through MS-13 territories. I should point out that this hasn't reduced the body count by any significant degree. We can learn this from a certain statement made by a member of MS-13. He said, quote, "The government asks us what we want, and we tell them, and they give it to us. We found out that if they say no, we just have to dump enough bodies on the street, then they say yes." End quote. The gang also owns a large number of legitimate businesses, which has enabled the gang to increase its capacities around Central America. A judicial investigation into MS-13 activities in El Salvador uncovered a multi-million dollar structure of legitimate businesses owned by the gang. Ironically, the seed money for these enterprises came from the government of El Salvador. For us to talk about that seed money, we have to go back to the late 2000s, specifically from 2009 to 2014, and talk about the Salvadoran president at the time, Mauricio Funes. Mauricio Funes was the president of El Salvador from 2009 to 2014. He was a member of the FMLN, which remains active to this day. He was actually the very first party leader of the FMLN who didn't fight in the Salvadoran Civil War. Before that, Mauricio Funes was a journalist who hosted a popular interview show on television. You know, people should have learned from him not to elect TV personalities anywhere on the planet after his harebrained scheme in 2012. Let's talk about this harebrained scheme in detail. Mauricio Funes was faced with a problem. That problem was the fact that his country had one of the highest homicide rates on the planet. To combat this problem, he decided to call for a truce between the two main warring gangs, the MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang. The truce would be the result of a secret pact between President Mauricio Funes, his defense minister, David Munguia Paez, and the imprisoned leadership of the gangs. The pact went like this. The MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang would agree to lower homicides. In return, the gang leaders would be transferred from the maximum security prison in Zacatecoluca to medium security facilities, where they could have access to their mid-level commanders and their rank and file. They would also enjoy more amenities and have greater access to their family and friends. The agreement also allowed them to communicate freely to their mid- and low-level gang leaders on the streets and enforce the truce. At least they were not allowed to build their own prison like Pablo Escobar. Anyway, the gangs were also paid up to $25 million by putting their notorious gang members on the government payroll in some municipalities. The surprising thing was, it worked! Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating just a little bit. What happened was, the homicide rate plummeted, but guess what went up? Disappearance rates. See, what the gang did was, they stopped killing each other publicly, and instead, did it in more intimate settings. Mass graves have been found that link back to this specific time period when the truce was still active. The truce lasted all of 16 months, and then the gangs were back to killing each other and innocent civilians in broad daylight. This truce, however, had one disturbing result. The MS-13 discovered that it had some real political power. A video released in 2016 shows gang leaders speaking with members of the Opposition Nationalist Republican Alliance or ARENA party. In this video, the members are talking to the gang leaders about a scheme to exchange votes for money during the 2014 presidential election. In an audio recording that emerged just a few days later, a prominent member of the governing Farabundo Marti National Liberation Party or FMLN was negotiating with gang leaders during the same period. Two more videos leaked later and they showed FMLN officials and gang leaders talking about up to $10 million in government-financed microcredit, allegedly in return for votes during those same presidential elections. The videos illustrate the fact that gangs such as MS-13 have become a social and political movement in El Salvador, a process that the truce appears to have accelerated. Thank you very much, Mauricio. Perhaps you could invite the North Koreans to such a meeting. Oh wait, someone already did. After the truce, the gang leadership established what it called La Federación, or the Federation. The Federation was a group of up to 30 leaders outside the jails who were given powers equal to those inside the jails. The leaders also split El Salvador into four geographic areas to better channel communications, control their subordinates' use of violence, and systematically collect more revenue. Finally, they used this centralized control to expand their influence into the US, a process that has created a lot of problems for the East Coast, as we shall talk about later. Violence is back in El Salvador, particularly violence directed at women and children. The country's security situation resembles a low-intensity war with death squads, some of them involving police, assassinating suspected gang members in large numbers and dressing up the crime scenes as confrontations by planting evidence. On the other hand, gangs are targeting security forces when they are off duty, going as far as to assassinate them and their entire families. This, of course, has been helped by the gang's ability to smuggle advanced military spec weapons from the US into Central America through Mexico. This includes weapons such as AK-47s, AR-15s, Uzis, RPGs, and C4 explosives. Unfortunately, this war is nowhere near concluding because, with the guidance of former military members, many of whom have trained in the US, MS-13 has allegedly set up training camps in the Honduran province of Olancho. This has been able to take place because, to stop prejudicial killings by the police, the government in Honduras decided to fire a significant number of them, especially those who were suspected of corruption and human rights violations. Once these officers had been fired, they went to work for the criminal organizations, and in so doing, made the criminal organizations far deadlier than ever before. So, you may wonder, where does the MS-13 get money to run all those activities from? Well, apart from its government, MS-13 reportedly makes around $31.2 million, which may sound a lot until you realize that the gang numbers north of 40,000 in Central America alone, with some estimates going as far as 70,000 according to some sources. When you divide $31.2 million into 40,000, assuming that everybody gets the same amount of money, which is obviously not true, what you get is a salary that is lower than most minimum wages around the planet. There's a chance that this income, along with its numbers, has been grossly underestimated because most media, Western media, assume that MS-13 is the so-called mafia of the poor. The reason why I think this number is an underestimation is because, in Honduras, the gang controls major transit routes that are used for the shipment of cocaine and other illicit products. Anyone familiar with cocaine knows that it is worth a lot of money. Anyway, most of this multi-million dollar income comes from cocaine smuggling, while the rest comes from several illicit activities such as extortion, which is widespread in Honduras and El Salvador, sex trafficking, which has contributed to the country's high femicide rates. In fact, it is the third highest in the world, with 1 in 5,000 women murdered in 2016. And a bunch of other smaller ventures such as burglary and Grand Theft Auto. 80% of all the cars in El Salvador are alleged to have been stolen from the US. What happens is this. MS-13 allegedly steals cars in the US and then smuggles them into El Salvador. Once they reach El Salvador, the cars are exchanged with cocaine, which is then smuggled into the US through Mexico. MS-13 relies on its relationship with Los Zetas and the Mexican Mafia in its smuggling activities. We'll talk about both of these criminal organizations later in the show. So, as I mentioned earlier, the MS-13 has become very active in the US East Coast, specifically in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, New York, and New Jersey, bringing with it violence in the form of grisly murders, of which the first was the murder of Brenda Paz on July 13, 2003. Brenda Paz was a member of the MS-13 gang from Honduras who turned law enforcement informer. When her fellow gang members discovered this, they lured Brenda into the Shenandoah National Park in Virginia and proceeded to stab the then pregnant Brenda dozens of times, including directly into her unborn child. Brenda was 17 at the time, and her death shocked the entire East Coast. Her killing led to a crackdown, which forced the gang to go underground for a time. Unfortunately, it did not go underground completely. After all, it would resurface a few years later with a string of grisly murders, including those of Nissa Mikens and Kayla Cuevas, which we covered at the start of the show. Law enforcement officers found themselves increasingly overwhelmed from around 2015 as murders quickly skyrocketed, most of which had been perpetrated by members of MS-13. Since 2015, it is estimated that the gang has been responsible for up to 55 murders in Long Island and New York City alone. Most of these murders are distinctly vicious, partly because MS-13 doesn't use guns. Instead, they use machetes, which means that most of these victims are discovered in shallow graves, dismembered beyond recognition. According to my research, the reason why the cliques or cliquers have been so unstable as to result to gruesome public displays of murder is that they lack proper leadership. In fact, most of the MS-13 in the US doesn't have a centralized leadership. On paper, MS-13 has a clearly defined hierarchy, but on the ground, things are very different. Most of the orders come from ranflas in El Salvador and Honduras, but there isn't anyone to oversee their activities in the US. This may be partly because Most of the gang is composed of minors recruited directly from schools or coerced into joining after they've illegally crossed into the US. Gangs in schools around the US have become so prevalent that some schools confess hesitancy when it comes to admitting unaccompanied minors into schools, especially those who are also migrants. This being society of strife, we have to address the question of why. Why is it that such gangs as MS-13 and 18th Street have become so prevalent in Central American society that no matter what their government tries to do, they still end up getting stronger? The first reason is poverty, a lack of education, and employment opportunities. Several organizations working directly with gang members have asserted that the combination of poverty, social exclusion, and a lack of educational and job opportunities for at-risk youth are perpetuating the gang problem. Honduras, a country whose 30% of the population is aged between 15 to 24, had an unemployment rate of 25% in 2005, which has only gotten worse since the global pandemic began. In the same country, 65% of the country lives on less than $2 a day, making it one of the poorest countries in the world. The second reason is societal stigma. Societal stigmas against gangs and gang deportees from the United States have made the process of leaving a gang virtually impossible. If you know anything about MS-13, you know that its members feature full torso and face tattoos. They call these tattoos job stoppers. But in truth, these tattoos stop much more than jobs. They even stop a former member from being accepted into normal society. And because tattoo removal is extremely expensive, most members or former members spend their entire lives with them. Most gang members and former gang members who are deported from the US also happen to be native English speakers, meaning that even if they do learn Spanish, they'll end up conversing with an English accent. This lowers their chance of employability drastically. In other words, these deportees are neither recognized as Hondurans or Salvadorans, nor are they recognized as Americans, forcing them to have no choice but to remain in a gang. Many studies have observed that sensationalist media coverage of the gang phenomenon has also contributed to a sense of fear and insecurity in the region, and may have indirectly enhanced the reputation of the gangs portrayed. A 2006 USAID gangs assessment found that rival gangs in Honduras often competed to see who would attract the most media attention. They did so by resorting to worse crimes than those of other gangs, or by featuring more elaborate face tattoos compared to other gangs. In Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, politicians are quick to sponsor reports that exaggerate crimes committed by gangs, and also those that claim most crimes are committed by the youth, which is factually untrue. Most gangs, such as the MS-13, are made up of 11 to 40-year-olds. Yet the youth are used as runners, while the older people serve as the shot callers. So another reason is anti-gang law enforcement efforts. To give a proper example, we have to go back to the 1990s, and the way Central American governments reacted to the influx of gang members arriving from the United States. When gang violence rose in the 90s and 2000s, the Salvadoran government created a number of policies aimed at combating gang violence. Collectively, these policies were known as La Mano Dura or Firm Hand. Initially, these policies were seen as successful, but after some time, because they allowed people to be arrested based on appearance alone, prisons became overcrowded. This meant that different gangs were often in the same block, which resulted in increasing bouts of violence. To deal with this, Salvadoran officials decided to separate people based on gang adherence and faction. What resulted was a situation in which gangs were able to organize, recruit, and create hierarchies. So, in essence, gangs became more powerful as a direct consequence of the La Mano Dura policy. Gangs were also able to access modern amenities from prison, often by way of threats and bribery. This meant that it was now much safer for gangs to conduct business from the inside of prison rather than from the outside. After all, when you're in a prison that your entire gang controls, you do not need to fear assassination plots. The La Mano Dura policies also led to extrajudicial killings by security services, to the point where some youth felt that it was safer being in a gang because you had a higher chance of being protected. This may sound strange to many listeners, but you have to remember this. The security services arrested people based on appearance alone. It did not matter whether you were innocent or not. As for those arrested, well, very few made it to booking, let alone prison. Most of them actually disappeared. The US needs to think about dealing with the MS-13 problem directly, because no one else will. By continuously deporting gang members, the US is feeding a continuous cycle of violence and murder, especially because such policies don't even end up making the country safer in the first place. So, strifers, remember this story the next time you're watching Fox News or listening to your local politician and he or she happens to mention that illegal immigrants from Central America are bringing crime into the US. Thank you for listening. If you liked this episode, please remember to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you can, please support the show on patreon.com/societyofstrife and buymeacoffee.com/societyofstrife. You know, running a show that relies on factual content means I have to spend money on research material from places like Amazon and JSTOR, and also on online subscriptions for magazines and newspapers. So please do that. I am not supported by any big networks or by any sponsors. I do this on my own time and dime, and as much as I love doing it and love all of you for listening, you may also have noticed that I have no advertisements whatsoever on the show, and that's because options for advertisements are severely restricted for non-US podcasters, especially those in Africa and Asia. If you feel you cannot afford to do that, then please spread the word about the show to your friends and family. This would help the show immensely. Also, remember to keep an eye on the Society of Strife podcast feed or click subscribe wherever you listen to the show to get notified the minute a new episode comes out, because I'll be releasing our first bonus episode this coming Monday. It will be about the AR-15, its history and its many variants, and why it's become the weapon of choice for many mass shooters in the US and around the world. If I sound a little off during the recording of this episode, it's because I have not slept for several days. Anyway, until next week, it's been my pleasure. Goodbye and stay safe.